with their cameras, and you know, they could double check to see, you know, if they went as far as they thought they went. Although they, you know, they could tell with the rotation of the wheels and the amperage and all, but it actually leaves CW all over the planet. So yeah, you had three robins originally. Like Dick said, Spirit and Opportunity. Spirit had failed back in 2006. Let me drop it. Opportunity is still going into its 11th year now, back in 2004, January 3rd. And 2 weeks later, Spirit landed in an Opportunity, respectively. And they've been riding around ever since. Spirit couldn't continue on. They had such a bad wheel it wouldn't turn properly, and they just dragged it. One or even, you know, what they did is they dragged it backwards for years. But that finally quit. They got themselves on the side of a hill, and winter time came. Couldn't charge the panels properly. It was sitting at the wrong angle, and they never heard from it again. But Opportunity is still going. They're about to go into its seventh winter in a Mars. It's roughly 2 years to our one. You know, we have 2 years to the other way around. We have 2 years and Mars has 1 year. And Opportunity is now going into its seventh year, seventh winter. And so they're going to sit that on a proper angle at an endurance. Endurance crater, and then they went to Victory crater. Now they're at the big one. I think it's Endeavor crater, and it's going to be sitting in a proper location for a good couple of months. It's going through the coldest part of their winter, and they'll bring it back to life again in a couple of months. But it's been doing a lot of science. Set a record there. It's like 27 miles or something. All these years. In fact, there's one website you can go to, and they have navigation cameras on the bottom of Opportunity, and you can see they have it fast going, going through all the months and years, and from one end to the other. And then next to that, they have another map of where you are as it's going along, a little diagram of where it started and where it is now. Right now it's on the edge of a crater. And every now and then it stops and takes a... They set it up with a robotic arm. It's got a 7-foot robotic arm with about a 2.5-foot reach. And it'll go down and it has spectrometers on board to tell what kind of materials it's looking at. They're still doing all of that with Opportunity. And Curiosity, now it's up there a couple of years, 2012, August, that thing landed. And it's on its way to very close to Mount Sharp. It's actually there, but then, you know, it's going through like a little valley. They have to be very careful because these rocks, it's taking a beating. The thing weighs 2,000 pounds on Earth, and you got 1/3 of the weight on Mars, so that's what, 600 pounds. So it's still like a play a piano, you know, the weight of one of the things, and you put it on these wheels that are not rubber, they're metal, and they go over these little rocks here and there. They didn't have those problems too terribly with Spirit or Opportunity, but they do with Curiosity. And putting a, you know, pretty large holes in some locations. So they're spending a lot of time trying to get it to where it's got to go. And they want to go up, you know, up and down there, Mount Sharp, because that's like, you know, as far as geologists are concerned, going up and down these either mountains or craters are like time machines. And they want to evaluate different locations. But to get there, it's a problem. They use the cameras, and then they realize they got to go another way. They're using the high-rise camera on board the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. They're using the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to take pictures and plot the route. So pretty much it. They're still doing a lot of science. whatever signs they get, they evaluate. Scientists get a hold of it. I guess final results can come out, you know, maybe years from now, some of the stuff that they find. But they know it's proved its point that it did have water at the time. It did have organics, and they know it could have supported life. That was its main goal. Actually did that a couple of months after it was there. Got plutonium source on board, unlike the other rovers. That was solar panel. This thing's got a RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator. I believe it's putting out 300 watts, if I'm not mistaken. Or was it 103 watts? I have to look it up. But it's going to be working for a long time, John. Back to you.
Yeah, I was wondering, because we haven't talked about it in a while. Very good. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGP.
Was there someone else with a question?
Roger, it's KC2OAS, Mark.
Go right ahead, Mark.
I watched this movie, and it says here that NASA admits that they can't send humans through the Van Allen radiation belts. So, I mean, I don't know where these things are, before the moon, after the moon, but so how do we, you know, so what's going on with this thing here? With these radiation belts that man can't go through it.
Don't sound right.
On the case of the Apollo mission to each of the Apollo landings on the moon, they had to go through the radiation belt, they had to go through the Van Allen belt, but you don't dwell there. There's a whole lot of high-speed particles in that Van Allen belt. It's a sort of a ring around the Earth. You select the altitude of the International Space Station, so you're slightly below that ring of the Van Allen belt, but you're high enough up above the atmosphere. So you're walking a very narrow line of altitude on the International Space Station. You'd like to put it up a little bit higher so that it touches the atmosphere less and therefore the orbit doesn't decay as fast, but now you would be cooking the astronauts in the bottom of that Van Allen belt. So you don't want to dwell there, but for a brief period of time you're allowed to blast through it as they did on all of the Apollo missions. Is that sort of the answer you're looking for, Mark? KC2OIS, K2RIW?
Well, I got your answer, but I was saying that NASA's admitting that they can't do it, but I'll let it go with that.
Well, they did do it. And so when it comes to nuclear exposure, how much damage it can do, nuclear radiation exposure, how much damage it can do to biological materials, is a function of three things. How strong is the source, how far away is the source, and how long is the exposure duration. Of all the things that we do on planet Earth, the thing that was very surprising, this is a fairly recent discovery from my point of view, is these Veritasium educational videos. If you go to YouTube video and you type in the word Veritasium, V-E-R-I-T-A-S-I-U-M, you'll get a whole series of science presentations. They're about 8 minutes each, all done by this real good scientist named Derek Mueller of Australia. And what he did was to pick up a real good modern Geiger counter and went to all the places on planet Earth that are known to have high nuclear radiation. Let me drop. So he went to the Fukushima site of that nuclear meltdown that took place in Japan. He went to the Three Mile Island, he went to Chernobyl, he went to the Trinity site in the United States where the first atomic bomb was tested. He went to all these places and made nuclear radiation measurements. He then also measured the amount of cosmic ray nuclear radiation you get when you're at 10,000 feet, 20,000 feet, and 35,000 feet in an airplane. From that he estimated how much the astronauts are getting and so on. So you add all of these things together. You look at the whole great big picture. And by the way, on planet Earth, when it comes to one fixed site, the strongest nuclear radiation you could find was in the Chernobyl local hospital in Pripyat, I think is the name of the town. So in the hospital where they dumped all of the uniforms, where the volunteers that had to do the original cleanup, and most of them died, by the way, they got an extremely high exposure, and the uniforms that they took off got dumped into the basement of this hospital. And he went there and made a measurement that pegged the needle on his radiation detector. And I think the answer is you can only dwell there for a small number of minutes before you get a full years of dose exposure. But how he ends the program, which is real good and kind of exciting, is that where is the strongest nuclear radiation that any human being gets? And the answer is your general smoker. Because tobacco is a concentrator of, a very slight concentrator of radioactive plutonium and lead. The cigarette smoke that gets deposited on your lungs, it's a very low nuclear source, but it's one cell away from your blood system, and it's there for years at a time. So the total nuclear exposure that a smoker gets is considerably greater.
Repeater, timeout.
It's considerably greater than any of these other sites you can visit. And so we've got lots of evidence these days that cigarette smoking creates quite a lot of lung cancer and cardiac problems, quite a few other problems. In the past, we thought it was the toxic chemicals that were being created. It really is the mixture of the toxic chemicals and the nuclear radiation. And so that's a bit of a surprise. Had the Surgeon General known that specific information way back in the late 60s when he was making a pronouncement of how dangerous cigarette smoking was, we probably would have had quite a bit of different results up till now. Anybody with any further comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW, the TechNet.
WSON.
You got it, Paul.
Yeah, if they were ever serious about not sending people up again past the Van Allen belt, I mean, you could cancel the whole SLS program, the Space Launch System. They're going to be putting billions into, they already have, into that program to send people eventually to an asteroid and talking about going to the moons of Mars, eventually orbiting Mars, landing on Mars. All this has to take place. Say 2030, so they better make up their mind real fast. The only thing I could think of is they might be thinking that if somebody wanted to put them in that type of orbit, you wouldn't be able to sustain a human being in the Van Allen belt. It's the only thing I could think of without seeing the same report that Mark saw. Add that to the mix. Back to you, there.
Amen.
Go ahead, John.
EC2WGV. Maybe Paul saw the same program I saw on the, I think it was the Science Channel, about the collection of debris, how massive it is, and that 10 or 15 years, we may have difficulty launching because of the debris. So, did you see that program, Paul? Over to you, Paul.
I've seen programs about it, and one of the shows that they put on at the Cradle of Aviation, when you go there, they talk about the debris, and the whole movie involved with that planetarium. I don't know, call it planetarium, big screen, whatever they call that big screen. You know what I mean? With the big film. different groups are working on it. There's one launch that went up last week. We'll put that up. I think it was India. And they had a regular launch of satellite, but then there's always extra satellites that go up. And somebody had some kind of a sail that would open up and, not use the sun for propulsion or anything, but actually use the sail to attach to debris objects. And by opening up and creating this large area, the rarefied air in space, I mean, it's very rarefied, but if you open up a big enough sail, it'll be, similar to the ISS, when they point the solar rays in the direction that they're going, it actually slows them down a little bit. And if they put the edge on, the equivalent of avoiding, some kind of an atmosphere, It's very, very rarefied, but it's enough to slow you down. So there's different groups working on this. They just launched one by India about a week or so ago. And it worked out that the test piece that they had opened up, I think it was 15 meters, right, 15 meters or something. A big sail.
hole that a NATO round, 7.62 millimeter, in almost anything. Isn't that incredible?
Well, they got that gun. They got the NASA's got a gun that shoots little teeny tiny pellets, 17,000 miles per hour. They shoot it into different materials. In fact, the last one I saw was had to do with the Horizon spacecraft. That might have been on the Noble one. I don't know. I've seen so many of them. And they used the different materials and showing how it could penetrate the stuff. But I know Dick was on that Van Allen belt scene and radiation. You know, if we go to Pluto, we'll have a problem. There's very strong radiation there at Pluto. And Juno spacecraft, that's going to be the one I'm looking forward to next year. New Horizon will be out in the Kuiper belt. You have a big orbital scene coming July 4th of next year with Juno going into polar orbit. And that should be pretty exciting. Back to you, Dick.
I can't wait to see James Webb. I hope I'm here when that goes up. I'm like Dick. I want to see that. Over to you, Dick.
And the James Webb telescope is very nicely covered again in last Tuesday's Italian section of the New York Times called The Telescope of the 230s. And that's on page Delta 3 of the New York Times on July 14th. Very nicely done article about it. And that's one hell of a telescope. I sure hope that goes well. I mean, it's a, I think it originally was scheduled to be around $1 billion, and for a whole bunch of reasons, it's now turning into something quite a bit more expensive. It came close to getting canceled, but NASA had to slow down or cancel some other programs in order to continue to support the James Webb, because arguably the most productive piece of hardware NASA has ever produced is Hubble, and James Webb could very well be twice as good as Hubble, is my estimation. Let me drop a quick. It's a much bigger mirror, infrared, much more sensitive, in a better location. All of that's good news. The bad news is because it's going to be in Lagrange Point, number 2, I think it is, the one that's on the backside of the Earth away from the Sun, a million miles away. Except for a robot mission, there will be no repairs for James Webb, so it better be perfect. Whereas in the case of Hubble, I think there were a total of 5 repair missions, and it got more and more sensitive, better and better detectors each time. I'd like to believe that we've come to the level of perfection of detectors for James Webb, that they won't have to be replaced. I think they're going to be, because it's an infrared sensitive telescope, I think they're going to be cryogenically cooled, in which case, whatever does the cryogenic cooling, like local helium gas, helium liquid that gets boiled off, that's something that's finite and it's going to eventually boil away. I'd like to believe there's a backup technique for doing almost the same level of cooling of those detectors. I bet you've got some words on this one now, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, and the Tech Man.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons they have that big sun shield. You know, they plan on keeping this thing around. It's supposed to be, you know, good for 10 years or something, so that means that I'm relying on the cryogenics. See what happens. You know, they have layer after layer of this Mylar sheet that's going to go out. It's going to be as big as a tennis court. The shade is going to be as big as a tennis court protecting this large spacecraft with a 21-foot diameter mirror. So, I don't know what the story is with the cryogenics. I know you can't keep it trapped forever. It tends to boil off. You always use helium. You gotta find a better way around that to do this. So, Lagrange Point 2, Dick. So it'll be a million miles out. There is gonna be a docking collar on there. So if somebody gets a bright idea, 10, 15 years down the road from now, goes out to service it even with a robotic machine. You know, we don't care, we can throw the robot away. not bring it back. If you have to bring somebody back, that's a big problem. But you're going to need a bigger rocket. I just want to go back real quick to, I think it was last week or the week before, you were asking about the rotation of Pluto. You know, how many times it turns on its axis. So I came out with, it turns out it was 6.38 days, Earth days, is one rotation. So that means that the whole planet was able to come into view, even as it backed away. They were able to see the front side. Able to see the front side and the back side. The back side, they were using light from Charon, the moon, like we have Earth shine and moon shine. Well, they were using Charon shine to light up the backside of the Earth. So even so, it takes a lot of days for this whole thing to turn. So they expect, they ask them, do you expect to get a complete look at the whole sphere of this place, of this Pluto? The answer is yes, over time when all the data comes back. So it's quite an accomplishment. Back to you, Dan.
Quick comments, Dick?
John, recognized, but a quick question, Paul. Three transmissions ago, you said there's a lot of radiation near Pluto. I wonder if you meant near Jupiter. When New Horizons did its gravity assist slingshot effect near Jupiter, I think it got exposed to quite a bit of radiation near Pluto, near Jupiter. I didn't think Pluto had a lot of radiation nearby. Run that by again, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
I got Pluto on my mind. Jupiter, of course, Jupiter is the strongest radiation field outside of the sun, and Juno, which is going there, will be there in July 4th, has protection on board. The electronics are mounted in a titanium vault, you might call it, because it's going to be interacting with their radiation. It's going to be on elliptical, you know, it's going to go in low, you know, thousands of miles above the planet, you know, and then far out. And New Horizon had to do the same thing. No, New Horizon came within 500 miles, they said, of the planet. They needed to get that boost of speed, and the closer you get, the faster you're going to go. And they picked up, they said they added 25% of the velocity at that point. So, you know, they got them up to, which turned out to be now 31,000 miles per hour as it goes past Pluto. So, you know, it slowed down as it goes out into space. You know, the sun's pulling on it, the Earth's pulling on it. And then it increased by 8,000 miles per hour with that gravity assist from Jupiter, but it had to go within the radiation belts and 500 miles of the planet to do it. And it survived and took great pictures of Jupiter when I was there. Jupiter is what I meant there.
Well done. And I did find my listing in my little calculator. I wrote it down. New Horizons, the uplink is 7,182 megahertz. 7,182 uplink. Downlink is 8,438. Megahertz, 8.4 gigahertz downlink. And so, of all the ham radio operations that have listened to deep space networks, I haven't heard of anybody trying to listen to this New Horizon. That's a tough one. John, KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
Did they say anything about two uplink frequencies? I couldn't find that in the paperwork. There's apparently a second uplink frequency.
I haven't found that yet, but I'm going to keep looking. You got it, John.
That was for the second computer when the spacecraft failed on July 4th, and it took them 3 days or 4 days to get it running. They used a different frequency and they went to get to the backup computer. John, over to you.
Boy, it sounds like we came awful close to getting a major failure. Thank goodness that didn't occur right at the time of the flyby. You got it, John.
WGB, yeah, that would have been sad. Dick, I don't know if you're aware of it, but Science Times on Tuesday, that's not a section, it's called a book in the publishing industry. That book is such a loss for the New York Times. I love it. I hope they're able to continue that, because evidently the advertisers don't want to be located primarily in that particular book. They want to be in other more popular books. So if it comes, push comes to shove, because it's such a big loss to them, because of the amount of effort they have to put into it, I hope they'll be able to continue that. Now, on another note, getting back to the Hubble and James Webb, what do you think the application may initiate a repair again on the Hubble? Because even though they're different types of telescope, they could be used to make simultaneous stereoscopic views in different spectrum. What do you think of that?
As it is right now, NASA makes it sound like they're not going to do any more manned missions to Hubble to do repairs. But they said those words once before, and there was a fifth repair mission. Everybody was screaming and hollering, you can't give up on Hubble. It's the best thing we've ever had. For that matter, all of NASA, I mean, it's the best thing we've ever had. I'm going to show you where I'm going with this Hubble. I mean, Paul, give me a repeat. I believe you told me that the total NASA budget right now is in the vicinity of $18 billion a year. Is that true, Paul? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
The ongoing number for quite a few years, you know, it goes up a little and then down a little bit. You know, they got set up, they cut off $500 million, but it's roughly $18 billion. And for instance, James Webb is $8 billion. You know, so that gives you a good idea. But that $8 billion is spread over, I guess, 10-year period of construction and all of that, right here.
And we can always find a critic who said, why the heck are we spending money in space? And it's a very naive statement, because every single dollar we spend with NASA, with rare exception, is spent in the United States, and it's giving our American scientists work, and very good things fall out of it. Roughly a 5-to-1 fallout. Every dollar you spend on NASA, you get $5 worth of beneficial objects being created for the benefit of mankind: computers and ceramics and medical testing techniques and so on. But if you took the $18 billion, decided, I'm not going to give it to NASA, I'm going to give it to the American public. You give that money evenly distributed to every man, woman, and child in the United States. It's $55 a year. That's a little bit more than $1.15 per week. It's roughly 15 cents a day. Give every man, woman, and child $1 per week of money that used to go to NASA. Is that really going to solve all their problems? I kind of doubt it. On top of that, the Science Times article talks about the fact that, yes, James Webb is around $8 billion. The high particle accelerator in CERN is around $10 billion. We used to think that was a lot of money. We dropped. But the Troubled Asset Recovery Program that occurred in, 2007, I think it was, that recovery program was $700 billion to make sure our banks wouldn't fail. So once in a while to spend $8 billion on a project like James Webb, and if all goes well, we're going to use it for the next 20 years. Is probably going to give us a hell of a lot better pictures than they ever got with Hubble. From my point of view, it's money well spent. I know that John last week was saying, could we get Americans to contribute to that? And I got a vague idea what some of the Americans are willing to contribute. Let me drop them. Because there were a whole bunch of high school students trying to shame people by saying, hey, you're not going to repair Hubble, because you think you can't afford it, and you think it's too risky. And a bunch of high school students are saying, I'm going to give money, so we'll do it with private funding. Okay. All of a sudden, there was another repair mission. So if the American public is going to make contributions to something worthwhile, like NASA, we estimate they're going to come up with maybe total United States contribution, voluntarily, $1 billion. I can just barely understand that. But for a project, for an organization that needs $18 billion a year, don't think there's enough money to privately fund it, with the exception of one hell of a contribution of Warren Buffett and, what was that name?
Gates.
Yeah, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. They could do it, but short of them, not likely. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this, before I go into another subject, give me a call. It is right now. K2IW, the Tech Nation.
You could call the funding, Dick, a war on educational deficit. There you go.
You got to give it a fancy acronym. If you made that into letters and pronounced it, what would it sound like, John?
Red. W-E-D?
Yep, RED. The wedding program. Okay? I think it was about 2 weeks ago we started discussing what is the weight of electricity. And boy, that branched into all kinds of things. But the original question, what is the weight of electricity? And yes, we can easily estimate how many electrons flow through that cable that goes between your battery and the starter motor. On a cold morning, there might be close to 200 amperes flowing through that cable. And in theory, you could measure those electrons. But there's a catch. And that is, although the total number of free electrons in all those copper molecules of that web cable that goes between your battery and the starter motor, if Mother Nature would let you do it, you could drain those 200 amperes worth of electrons out of there for 4 solid hours. But she won't let you do that. It's like marbles in a pipe. You take one electron out of the far end of that cable, and Mother Nature dictates that you put another electron in the leading edge of that cable. Otherwise, the current ain't going to flow. You're not balancing it, if you know what I mean. So it's like marbles in a pipe. So if the marbles in the pipe, let me drop. If the marbles in the pipe are sitting still because no current is flowing through your cable, and then later on you close the solenoid on your starter motor, and close to 200 amperes flows at first, because the number of electrons going in and number of electrons coming out is the same. There's no real change in weight of the cable. And if you try to make that measurement, you've got another problem. You'd have to probably do it in a vacuum, because at any reasonable amount of current flow through the cable, it's going to run a little bit warmer. A little bit warmer means that there's going to be convective air currents around the cable. That's going to make it seem lighter, but it's really airflow that's doing it, not electron flow. So you'd have to do the experiment in a vacuum. But that branched into all kinds of things about what do electrons weigh and what do protons weigh. And so we've had various people expressing opinions that once you take an atom and you take it apart, that because you're breaking the strong bond in the center and the gluon plasma that holds the nucleus together, you're no longer getting the weight of that gluon plasma in the gluon itself, that separate protons probably weigh quite a bit lighter than protons that are part of a nucleus of an atom. Let me drop. But that mass of a proton is not zero. That mass of an electron free is not zero. Obvious by the fact that when you accelerate it in a particle accelerator, you're intentionally giving it a whole lot of kinetic energy, and it's ending up with kinetic energy and also momentum. And if you don't have any, if you have any doubt about that, all you got to do is Google the word particle accelerator target recoil. Google those words. I have. Particle accelerator target recoil. And you find out that in the early days of using particle accelerators, they would have a stationary target. And they soon realized that a lot of the energy that they wanted to go into the smashing of protons or electrons against the target was being eaten up by the fact that the momentum of the particles that had accelerated hits the target, and the target backs away. The target recoils. You need conservation of momentum. Whatever momentum the particles you've accelerated had before they hit the target, after they hit the target and the target moves, a significant amount of that potential, a significant amount of that momentum is coupled into the target, and the target backs away. And you get a lot of loss of the original energy you paid heavily for to accelerate those particles. Here's what they did for a solution. Let me drop. by making sure that the target is also moving, get around that problem. By now making your particle accelerator, so you've got a whole bunch of particles going around the ring clockwise, and you've got a whole bunch of particles going around the ring counterclockwise, now when they meet, for the times that you're able to make them hit head-on, they both go from high velocity to zero velocity, and now all the momentum is conserved, all the energy of those two beams gets converted into the collision that you decided, that you desired, and now you get a much better, much more efficient experiment. But as you can tell, because of target recoil that you get with a stationary target and a particle accelerator, there's no doubt in the world that those particles, even though they've been separated from a molecule or an atom, they've got mass. Almost everybody will agree, not everybody, I said almost everybody will agree, that when they've got mass, gravity will affect them. Because if the gravity can affect an atom or a molecule, who in the world is telling gravity, hey, that's not an atom or a molecule, those are individual components of an atom or a molecule, and you're not supposed to have gravity acting on them, they're not supposed to have weight. Where does the intelligence of gravity come from to do that? Now, various doctoral graduate people were asked that question, and depending on who you ask, you get different answers. Let me drop. We have our own local doctor, AC2TS, Dr. Lawfer, who is fairly sure that anything that has mass, gravity will affect it. There are other doctoral candidates or doctoral graduates who come to the conclusion because of what they were told, because no human being has ever seen an atom or a molecule. We all are operating on the knowledge that has been given to us with the particular educational process you've been through. So if you've got your doctorate degree in something to do with physics, and if your particular instructors told you that in what they were told, that massive particles, when they're separated from their atom, no longer is gravity affecting them, they no longer have weight. If your instructors told you that, and you repeat that information, that's a good source of information. Is it the gospel truth? Is an interesting question. So as you can tell, I think to some degree the jury is still out on this one. You've heard two or three different sides of the story, John, and I know you've got some opinions on it. KC2WGB, K2RIW and the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick. I sort of agree with Glenn. Now, Glenn, I wish he was here. He could explain it a lot better than I do. He said that the individual particles in the atom, when they're dislodged, they are just energy. Yes, they have mass if you accelerate them, yes. And when they're impacting something, you could convert that to a type of weight. But, well, I wish Glenn was here tonight. I thought he would be. But, I sort of agree with Glenn, and Roy brings up some wonderful points. In fact, he brought up a great point that you got an email also, which I will bring up next week because I'm collecting other data from similar questions from other listeners. So, I don't align perfectly with either one of them, but I sort of lean toward Glenn.
W-H-R-Y-Y.
Joe recognized, and I lean toward Roy. And you can tell that I had an opinion like that to begin with.
Forget what you said about the instructors, that has reciprocity, so it doesn't really mean much.
Every object, whether it's moving or stationary, usually has an amount of mass, and that mass by E equals mc squared could be called energy if you like, that if you're able to make the conversion from mass to energy, you can evaluate how many joules of energy you're going to get. So, does a light beam have mass? A little bit. Does it have energy? Certainly. I mean, neutrinos even have mass. Can you mention any kind of a particle that you can accelerate that has no mass? And if it doesn't have real mass at the time of acceleration, then when it hits a target, why would you get target recoil? Why would you get a conversion of momentum from the particle to momentum of the target? I think mass is there all the time, but not everybody's going to agree with me. Joe's going to straighten this out for us. To B2RYY, K2RIW, Joe.
We're in trouble now.
Thanks, think so? No, I was going to ask you, does anything not have mass? Does everything seem to be affected by gravity, even photons of light, or light made up of photons? This is correct. Now, my question is, if this is true, that aren't these particles, doesn't the mass become approaching infinity as it accelerated towards the speed of light? So it hits something, it departs that energy. Well, you can hit the face with a flashlight. Does it bother you?
It depends on how strong your flashlight is. I will admit that the mass of photons, of optical photons, is an extremely small number. But by the fact that those photons can definitely be bent in space, I mean, we do have gravity lensing effects. If you get something as heavy as a really massive galaxy or a group of galaxies, and you've got a star system beyond it, the light gets bent around that mass of those galaxies. So light beams do bend because of gravity. That suggests they've got real mass. And so is it any kind of a particle we can talk about that it has no mass? I think the answer is no. A neutrino is about the lowest mass object anybody can imagine. And yes, it happens to have zero charge, so that makes accelerating neutrinos after they've been created very difficult. But the acceleration of the particles that smash into a target that give you neutrinos, that can be done. And as you know, that was done at CERN. They intentionally were shooting that beam into a target, making neutrinos. The neutrinos were going through the Earth, being picked up in Italy, 400 miles away, and trying to do the timing as to how long they got there. And so at first they thought they were getting there faster than the speed of light, until they discovered an error in the timing mechanism. So neutrinos, I think on average, a neutrino will go through the Earth with an extremely small percentage of the time of hitting anything. The neutrino particle is so extremely small and massless, it can walk right through any atom. And since an atom is mostly empty space, the chances of hitting something is very, very small. That's why it can go through the Earth without hitting anything most of the time. That's a really strange particle. Anybody have any further questions or comments? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Amen.
Go right ahead, John.
A little bit of an issue with the mass. I don't care how small it is. When you get up to those relativistic speeds, you're looking at infinite multiplier. Can't be. So I think those items that are traveling at that rate have no mass.
I suggest you're ready to be given the voice.
I'm going to lose the repeater. Got about 30 seconds.
2GS here. Rather late.
Hey, we've been talking about you, Roy. You got it, Roy.
Yeah, well, to cut it short, probably gravitons don't have any mass because they're unaffected by gravity, which is why gravity is felt outside the event horizon of a black hole. And things with a non-zero rest mass will reach infinite mass at the speed of light, which is why they can't reach the speed of light. But photons have a rest mass of zero. If you stop a photon's velocity, it ceases to exist. It pops out.
I would suggest that the repeater to be kept a little bit longer. Roy was waiting for his time, and you're giving him just a few minutes. That works here.
We didn't know Roy was on.
She said she's going to be on. I've heard it.
The only one.
Okay, guys, you don't have to extend, you can go to sleep and such. We can do this next week. We can do this anytime.
Yeah, there was an experiment where, with very high dielectric materials, they managed to make a beam of light move very, very slowly. And so, was it approaching a rest mass of near zero when they did that? I wonder if you've read about some of those experiments. Roy, over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
AC2GS here. Yes, but that's always in a media. The point about the speed of light is it's a constant in a vacuum. Once you place it in some kind of media, it can very easily seem to travel much, much slower. So the trick with the speed of light is you always have to say speed of light in a vacuum.
of light has got to be moving in order to really do its thing. I think you could say the same thing about a radio wave. Radio wave has got to be moving to do its thing. You don't know of anybody trying to... Yeah, you can create a standing wave. But a standing wave on an antenna, for instance, or inside of a resonator, it really is a wave moving moving left to right, and another wave moving right to left. And in order for it to be a resonator, a microwave resonator, you've got the equivalent of a short circuit or a perfect open circuit on the end. And so the energy going down to the end gets 100% reflected. So a transmission line, for instance, with a termination of some kind, short or open on the ends, where the signal bounces back and forth, it is a resonator. And we usually call that a microwave cavity. So I'm getting the impression a radio wave exists only if it's moving. And in reality, I don't think there is such a thing as a radio wave that doesn't move. And you're suggesting that there's no such thing as a light wave, photons that don't move. And so, you know, light wave and radio wave, the exact same phenomena, electromagnetic wave, just a slightly different frequency. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Exactly. A photon is a photon is a photon. From RF to visible to X-ray to gamma, they all work about the same way. As far as that's concerned. And with standing waves, you know, it's sort of a turn of phrase, because if you cut the power, the standing wave will collapse. It's not trapped there. So it's not the same as a light, as a photon just sitting there in space without any relative motion.
You're absolutely right. That cavity is a kind of an energy storage device. You turn off the source, and you watch it decay. And knowing the Q of the resonator tells you exactly how many cycles it's going to have before it decays. Okay, I know we're not going to settle this one tonight, and we're going to be discussing it in future weeks. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1565, and Space Report number 158, the one about New Horizons, after it did its flyby. We'll be back next week, and we'll try to settle these things a little bit more. And John's going to tell us how many mailbag questions he'll be covering next week, and whether or not he's going to be giving us another one of these zingers, where that last zinger 2 weeks ago, we haven't heard the end of this one yet, John. I think it's going to take a couple more weeks. KC2WGB, K2RW, be careful.
12, 0, 1.
at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL Repeater System. Good morning. The time is 1:17 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL Repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
Good morning. For some reason, We've totally lost Rich. I don't know what happened to him. I can't get him on either mode.
He's on this morning?
I was talking to him a little while ago.
All right, I'll text him and see if I can get an answer.
I thought for a second that it was my equipment because I wasn't hearing him on analog or digital.
See if I get a response when I just text him. All right, I'm on the viaduct now. Viaduct, I don't know. So, this is exactly the weather I had down where I came from.
Thanks for bringing it back with you. Nice and soupy.
Yeah, it's a little different when you're wearing a shirt and tie and trousers, as opposed to a t-shirt and shorts and topsiders.
Well, I got the trousers and the shoes and socks on, but I have not put the tie on. I am wearing a shirt, though.
Yeah, we don't feel that we should be wearing ties, but that's what they want us to do.
No, the tie will go on when I get into my office. I don't need to impress anyone while I'm driving.
How far down the pike are you?
I'm by Queen Center Mall. I'm out of range of Limewalk Digital.
Well, he responded to me, said, "Welcome back, Cotter," so I guess he's okay.
All right. We'll find out eventually what's going on. Let me know when you get in range of our Manhattan site.
Okay. I'm just going past the Miracle Month. Anyway, got in early. Very interesting. Got down there 25 minutes early on Thursday morning and got in last night almost a half hour earlier. So that was cool. Earlier is better than delayed.
Either both pilots had hot dates or you had tailwinds.
Yeah, he went on a little different route. I guess there were T-storms north of West Palm. So he swung out, like, straight across the Bermuda Triangle. And we went over Bermuda, which I hadn't seen during the daytime in a long time. I've seen it at night a few times, but not in the daytime. So that was nice.
Were you having a window seat, or were you one of those people who put on the map and watch where you are at all times?
No, it was a window seat. And it was a smaller plane, not the Airbus, the, what do they call that, the Embraer 190, two seats on each side. I like that plane.
Sometimes those planes have very narrow legroom, though.
Yeah, for the couple hours that you're sitting there, it's not too terrible. I like it. Quicker to get off because there's less people. They always seem to get there early. The Airbuses always take their time. Plus, there's 100 more people on the plane.
Okay.